Hi, this is Mary Santora, and you're listening to The Default Setting with Jess Falstick and Elizabeth Seaman. Enjoy.
To the default setting, where we find out what makes you tick because we have ways of making you talk. I'm your host, Jess Falstick.
And I'm your co-host, Elizabeth Seaman.
Today, we have a founder, co-founder, a comedian, and just general good buddy of ours, Mr. Brent Gambrell. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Good. I had like one sip of coffee, so I think I meant to say comedic Clee, and I said comedic Cleveland, and I'm not awake, so I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh. All of our throngs of fans are going to... All our Beyonce-like fans are
going to... Wait. Oh, God. You better edit this out, because wait till Twitter gets its hands on this.
Oh, my God.
It's beehive. Like the, when the beehive...
I was going to say the beehive is going to come after me.
The cleehive, bro. And there's six of them.
The cleehive. Hey.
They're demanding a guillotine.
Hey, Brent, your default setting is disengaged.
It is indeed.
Well, then stop being so engaging.
I know, so you're so fucking engaging. What the fuck? Stop that.
Said no one. I disengage all things. That's my poison of choice. I like it. It's good. It's it can be liberating or it can be terrifying, depending on how you look at it.
Is it like something that you feel like you do intentionally, or that it's just like naturally happens?
It was a thing that happened like ever since I was a kid. Like I had a weird year when I was 12 years old, and you know how like I think everyone in some point in their life kind of figures out, it's kind of like the Santa Claus, and then at some point you figure out you're gonna die. Mm-hmm. So I think that hit me like around 12 years old
when I had an existential crisis.
So I figured then I just went on like immediate fast forward. Like I just became, you know that theory like you shouldn't make your bed because you're just going to mess it up again?
Mm-hmm.
That's like life to me. Like don't put too much into life. You're just going to die at the end. Like,
that's so young to not care that.
I literally, at 12 years old, that was my outlook. I used to tell people that life was like a college dorm room, you know, put a few posters up or whatever, but don't get too attached. I'd like to be here that long.
See, we were talking about reincarnation on one of our previous episodes, and it just seems like that's where the whole old soul thing comes from, right? Like, you learn hard truths. Everybody learns hard truths when they're young, but the true acceptance of them when you're young really tells me, like, you have an old soul.
Yeah, well, I have an old body to match now. It's quickly catching up.
That's what I'm saying. It's like everyone's like, oh, you know, because I turned 30 last year. And it's like, oh, you know, freaking out. Like all my friends like, oh, I'm 30. And I'm like, I just feel like my age is catching up with my personality now. It's just like, oh, good. Now it makes more sense when I'm just like generally like old and cranky and ornery about things.
Shit, 30? 30 is like 4 million bongs ago.
I know. Right? You counted in bongs. I love that.
That's my timeline. That's how my frame of time.
How do you measure a year? And he measures them in bongs, everyone.
575,600 bong hits.
Oh, my God.
5,000 something bowls that I hit.
What about acid?
What about...
Oh my God!
And then we can
rename the musical Brent instead of Rent.
Oh, yes. If that ever happened, Megan would shoot me dead on the spot.
Oh
she
my God!
The musical Rent, or she doesn't want you out there talking about you so much.
If I defiled her first love of music,
there we go.
I was gonna say.
Okay.
Brent's very talented partner is Megan Brodigan. She's a, I would say, quadruple, quintuple threat. She's an actress, model, comedian. She's done a million things, so she's incredibly fascinating.
We love threatening her. In general, just threatening to me.
Well, did you have it coming?
Intimidation is how she rules.
That's why you don't have your camera on. She had to, like, give you a talking to earlier, and you're like, oh, I can't turn my camera on, guys. I got a black eye.
I was going to say, he's got a black eye.
Yeah, right?
Walking the door.
I fell five times into this knife. I first tried to weasel out of the camera thing because about maybe 2 years ago, I tried to FaceTime somebody and I saw it and I was like, oh, holy shit, where, goddamn, where's
the person? I can't do this to you.
Yeah, like mirrors and cameras I don't like because I can delude myself into thinking I'm still young and if I don't see my face.
It's funny now, I think, so I don't know if it's the app we're using Zoom right now for those of you listening at home, and it always seems to have an option no matter what device I'm using, whether it's my phone or a laptop or a webcam, that asks me if I want to use like the... It's almost like, not a glamour filter, but there's like a filter. So I'm actually using a filter right now. Like, my face is not normally like this flawless. Like, I know I don't look flawless, but like, I have like bumps and zits and like just shit. And,
I have a filter.
And you can turn that.
What's my filter?
I don't know. I'll find the setting and I'll send you. I'll send you a tutorial on how to enable the setting. Because now that's the thing. Like, I understand, like, a few years ago with FaceTime, everybody was using FaceTime and there's like, oh God. And so now they have this option where you can turn these filters on and just make yourself generally feel better about being on FaceTime, I think. Generally so that you will stay on their FaceTime network so that they can take more of your data by, like, scanning your face, is my guess. But
I'm looking for a filter like the hockey mask from Friday the 13th.
Hockey mask, yeah. I think you can do that now. My mom and I will FaceTime on the Facebook Messenger a lot because it's weird. You can't FaceTime using normal – so, like, if you use FaceTime – you have to be on Wi-Fi. You can't, like, just be out and about, like, using FaceTime. At least every time I try to, it always says you have to be connected to a Wi-Fi network. Maybe it's just my network. But when you use, like, Facebook Messenger, it doesn't care. You can just be, like, on data. And occasionally, because, you know, she's my mom, she'll, like, be pressing things. Then she'll all of a sudden have, like, a cat face while we're talking. And I'll be like, whoa, shit, I didn't even know you could do that. But apparently, yeah, that's a thing you can do now. You can just spend the whole conversation with, like, you know, like you said, a hockey mask or something.
I was wondering what my image was, like, if I had a little, like, kind of those old Wii Me things on there.
Oh, yeah!
Just some friendly little cartoon character waving at you.
Oh, my God, I used to be obsessed with making my Miis back in the day. I would spend hours making those things.
That's a girl thing. They do that for a long time.
I never did that.
Yeah.
It's not a good use of your time.
No.
I would definitely disengage that activity.
Well, that's like... That was back when I was married and boring and didn't, like, do comedy or anything interesting or fun. So that's the kind of shit you do when you have a lot of free time, I guess.
That was BC before comedy.
BC before comedy. So, like, it's interesting. So when you say disengage, I think there's a bunch of different ways that can be interpreted. And you were talking about back when you were younger, when you described disengage, it had more to do with sort of, like, a more of, like, a casual attitude towards things.
Yeah, like no life goals.
Mm-hmm.
I have none.
I mean, that's impressive because considering like you have no goals, you guys get a lot done. I know after, you know, when you prior to doing all the stuff you're doing right now, you were a promoter, correct?
Yeah, a little bit.
And like, was that? I mean, how was that with your whole sort of life philosophy? I mean, like, was it awful?
It was the worst time of my life.
Okay.
I have to pretend like I care about this thing so much to make other people care, and I
fucked up and succeeded at something, and it was awful. It was everything I feared, and it was the whole reason I avoided everything, and I got out of it as quickly as I could.
Okay.
I worked in MMA and fighting, and I started a league like to be like, originally it was just a goof. Like, I wanted to be like Fight Club kind of thing and just watch people beat the shit out of each other and watch people bet on it willingly, of course. But then I found out that was MMA was getting legalized and it was blah, blah, blah. So we started, my partner and I started an actual legal sports, like, certified league. And we became kind of like a known minor league for the UFC, which was awful because then, like, responsibility and you're overseen by the athletic commission and, oh, man, it's a nightmare. Like, getting up, I just can't get up at certain times for certain things. That just is bullshit. It's just bullshit, man. Because the whole thing about seeing your mortality and understanding it from a young age is you really value your time a lot, you know?
Interesting. So then did you, like, was there something that caused you to have that existential crisis?
Yeah, just a weird year I had. You know, like, when I was 12 years old, some weird shit happened. Like, my grandpa died, and I was real close with my grandpa, and he died, like, suddenly on vacation. Even though he had heart problems and everything else, it wasn't like he was ever sick. He just died one day on vacation. And then shortly after that, my dad had a car accident in which he wasn't injured, but he passed out at the wheel, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. So those two things happened about 3 months apart. And then a really weird thing happened. My dad was a basketball coach at a school in Cleveland called John F. Kennedy High School.
Oh, wow.
I used to always, our whole family would go to every basketball game. Like, I've gone to hundreds, if not thousands, of those games. Mm-hmm. And so that was like our second family out there. And one time at an away game at, I think it was East High School, there was a shooting. And I used to worship my dad's players when I was a little kid. So I would sneak to places where I wasn't supposed to be. And one of the places I snuck out was, that was like a gang activity game. Like, there was a lot of threats made in the weeks leading up to that game. So this was back when, you know, that was a big thing, like in the early 80s, there was a lot of gang violence in Cleveland. And so I was walking out with the players where I wasn't supposed to be when my family was inside the building with the police, but I had snuck out with the players. And then someone on the roof shot a cheerleader that was standing with us, just shot her in the leg, didn't kill her. And
still,
she went down. And so the dudes picked me up and, like, ended up putting me on a bus and stuff. So, like, and then a whole big thing, you know, it took a while for that to transpire. So that was, like, a weird year for me. And it was also weird for me because nobody went and got the girl that got shot. And, like, in the movies, everybody, like, drags the girl to safety.
Left her there?
Well, it wasn't really a purposeful thing, but like, she went down and everybody scattered because they were just shooting from the roof. So, It was like a weird thing, and it's probably a lot more dramatic than it sounds. It sounds a lot more dramatic than it was.
Well, no, it sounds like it's pretty intense.
But the weird thing about that is it didn't really freak me out when I was 12 years old. I thought it was not cool that she got shot, but I thought it was just the wildest thing. Like, you know, I went to school in Westlake, so like, but what did you do last weekend? Was nobody ever believed me?
I think, like, I was just talking about this with my boss yesterday, how, like, until we're, like, adults and even maybe well into adulthood, we don't really develop that ability to, like, go, whoa, that was fucked up, right? You know what I mean? So, like, because you're still developing, like, what's normal, right? Like, you're still feeling out, like, what's just, like, a part of life. So when you're 12 and someone gets shot in front of you, it's like, yeah, that's crazy. But then, like, you still don't have the capacity to go, oh, that's not something that just happens. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not really that different than when you see it on TV, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? It's just less impressive. I don't mean like less impressive. It makes less of an impression on you. I mean, it's like everything on TV is cool about everything. And then when it happens, it's just a really fucked up, chaotic situation. So that type of shit puts a different spin on. And then also living literally a double life by living half of my time in that situation with my dad. Mm-hmm. And then my mom was a Westlake school teacher at an elementary school, so she had a completely different outlook on life. Like, we used to always joke that if you talk out in class, my mom would think your life was over and you're going to prison for the rest of your life. And my dad, if you didn't kill anybody, everything was fine. So when you got in trouble, you definitely went to see my dad. You did not go to see my mom.
That's awesome. I mean, do you, it sounds kind of like your dad sort of shared the whole, like, a little bit of where you come from with the disengagement thing, like, just sort of like, as long as you're showing up and trying sort of thing.
Oh no, my dad hates it. Like, I passed out. It's hard to talk about sometimes, and nobody really knows this about me except my really, really close family. But like, I had all these opportunities when I was a kid, and for several reasons, like, I just didn't. What happens with when you're 12 years old, if you see something really weird, you'll start to dream about it. And then what happens is whatever you dream about repeatedly becomes reality to you. So what really happened that day is real foggy for me, but apparently throughout the years, I dreamt over and over these sequences. And so it develops into PTSD. So I got diagnosed with PTSD at a pretty young age, and then it develops into other things. But it gets, you know, it just gives you a very weird outlook on life compared to other people. And then you learn not to want to socialize a lot. So, like, when I was in high school, my dad is my mom and dad are like the biggest baseball fans in the world. My mom passed away like a little bit over a year ago, but that's fine. I don't want to be a downer, but while she was able to, she had my dad and mom would have season tickets every summer or every winter for the spring training. I guess spring training would take place in the spring.
So well, you know.
For the Indians and the Dodgers, and they would go out there and watch that shit. So they were super into baseball. And then when I was in high school, after I graduated, I had a chance to go and play like in a couple different pro leagues, minor leagues and shit like that. But I was like so disengaging that I was like, no, I don't want to do that. So then I went and played football in college, and I dropped out literally 3 times on scholarship. So it's not always been fun for my parents, my theory on life, you know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, when you're in the throes of a disengagement, I mean, is it kind of like, is it because you're feeling pressure? Is it because you're feeling disinterested? Where does it come from?
Yeah, I just don't have an interest in it. Like, I don't understand people's interests. Like, and this will blow your mind, and you might get kicked out of L.A. for talking to me now. But, like, I don't understand people who want to be famous or, like, I would despise fame. Not that, you know, I'm not saying everybody wants me to be famous. I'm just saying, would it be in my, you know, future, in my destiny to be famous? That would be awful. I would hate that, and I would avoid that, like I would avoid any kind of disease that would kill you. It's the worst.
It's interesting you say that because there is a very, I think fame and success in the entertainment industry have been conflated as kind of the same thing for a really long time. And what's interesting is I was reading about Adam Watch's Peaky Blinders, and I've become obsessed with Cillian Murphy. He's just so fucking hot to me. But
that note.
but he is this amazing actor. He's such a good actor, and he absolutely hates fame. He hates it. He hates doing press. He hates going to, like, you know, premieres. He hates all of that shit. And it's almost like a lot of people, I think, are trying to establish there can be a mutual exclusivity between the two. Like, you can still be culturally very successful, but try to still slough off, you know, the obligations and
you got to really hit the artistic lottery with that, though, you know what I mean?
True
Because, like, you got to really do something meaningful to be able to subvert all the, you know, constant social media presence of someone like a Kardashian or all the people who live for, like, you have to follow every second of their lives. I mean, I can't get through a news feed online without seeing shit about all the Hadid sisters and who fucking Brad Pitt dated 10 years ago. It's like Brad Pitt, that's my nightmare, dude. Like, that guy, people are like, oh, I want to be like Brad. No, you don't. You know what Brad Pitt wants? He wants to go to a movie and have nobody recognize him. Or he wants to go to McDonald's and eat a goddamn cheeseburger in private. You know, just sit there and have nobody pay attention.
My biggest thing is if I ever get famous, like, the thing that I would get sick of all the time is just the constant, like, everyone has something to say about you. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, and none of it's accurate.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and that's why I try, like, out of, like, a karma, I've talked about this before, out of this, I feel like, karmic responsibility. Like, I try not to shit too much on anyone, even if they do, like, publicly kind of suck. Because it's like, we don't know them. We're only getting, like, a minuscule fraction of a fraction of a fraction into, like, how that person is. And, like, I try really hard not to feed into the whole, like, this actor sucks, this musician's terrible, you know, all that shit.
Yeah, I get that. Came to me with getting older. I used to think I was, like, hot shit and say, hey, this guy sucked, that guy sucked. But now everybody's better. I appreciate everybody a lot more now that I see, you know, I suck sometimes. So it's a lot easier to appreciate when people succeed, especially now, being, like, as old as I am and seeing people like this Coco Gauff girl. And then we were watching Shark Tank reruns last night because life is super exciting. And it was, like, all about kids. There was a 6-year-old kid on Shark Tank.
Oh, whoa. Wow.
Yeah, holy shit, man. 6 years old on Shark Tank. And, like, you know, there's one Zion Williamson kid's 19 years old and lighting up the NBA. So the older you get, the less, you know, the less cocky about success you can be. Because when you're getting, you know, when 9-year-olds are overachieving,
yeah,
everything you've ever done in your life, it's super humbling. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that adds to a lot of like pressure for some people too, but does it help to kind of, I mean, do you ever find yourself reverting back to that or original sort of thought process if you're feeling like pressured or you're feeling, you know, excessively humbled that, you know, it's, you're just strapping in for the ride sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I've been, the one thing that's always been real weird about me is I've always been not an independent thinker in a way that makes it sound cool. Just, I've always been an independent thinker more in a stubborn kind of asshole way that makes me think that I can maybe do something better. So that, but it in the end, it's as much pain in the ass as it is. I live a weird life. You know, you have to sign up for things like you and Elizabeth probably could never want to be like this. Because there's a lot of things I can't do. For instance, hard for me to get on planes, leave the country, do things like that, because I don't have a driver's license.
Okay.
Everybody thinks that I have DUIs or something, but I just don't drive.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It frustrates me, so I disengage it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't like people in general, the selfishness and greed of people. Ooh. And never, there's nowhere really that you can see it more than when they're driving.
Oh, my these God.
These fucking little pricks, and they and there's no recourse for them, and that's why everybody's going to cut you off and risk your life and do so. I just don't worry about it, man. I've driven throughout my whole life, but I've had a driver's license. I'm 49 years old, and I've had a driver's license maybe like 6 years of my life.
Okay.
Now, keep in mind, I've owned vehicles the whole time. And I drove for years and years. I mean, I dropped my kids off at school for like 10 years in a row and never got in trouble for anything, but it's all bullshit. Like, disengage, one of the biggest things I disengage is the government. I don't interact with the government unless I have to. I mean, I don't do anything illegal now that weed's legal, but I don't have any assets. I don't have a bank account. I don't have a driver's license or anything.
Oh my God, you're off the fucking grid.
Yeah, and it's
you're like a post-depression, like, no, the banks.
But I've been like this since I was like 20 years old.
But okay.
Like, I've been like this for almost three decades now.
Okay, so this brings up a really good question. Like, there almost kind of seems this paradox, right? And I kind of want to get some clarity on, like, so when you talk about disengaging from the government, I feel like in a lot of ways, to get to the level even just that you're at, that takes effort. So, like,
oh, yeah.
So, I mean, like, it almost kind of seems like disengagement to me kind of, at least in this sense, seems more passive, and this seems more like actively attempting to get just not uninvolved with something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because I hate it. I hate what happens, and I hate that we have no voice. And I, you know, I don't want to get all good.
No, yeah, dude, we talk about this shit all the time on here. It's totally fine.
Voting, like a voting, our voting system dilutes our votes, so we have no say in anything that they do. So why would I want to generate a bunch of money if I'm successful? They're going to take 45 to 60% of my income through taxes.
Yeah.
That's just the income tax, and then they're going to take them all through sales tax and everything else. So the more financially successful and financially wound up I get, the more I'm paying into a system where I don't agree with most of the decisions of how they, you know, I'm not trying to pay for fucking drone strikes on families and shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm not looking to do that. And I would like for us to have a one vote, one person, one vote type, say, bipartisan politics, electoral colleges, gerrymandering of districts. It dilutes the voting system until it's just like political pro wrestling.
Yeah.
Yeah, they kind of just make it do whatever they want.
Yeah, you only get two choices to start with.
You can just make it do what you want it to do.
Yeah, you only really get two choices to start with for a presidential election. And then if any third party gets even the least bit popular, whoever they're competing with, they're just both screwed, and the least popular person out of the three people wins anyway. It's mathematically defunct, man, at best.
It's so funny. I was just talking to Ryan DePerna on Instagram.
I love Ryan DePerna.
I love him. He's amazing. Well, it's funny because I've been razzing him the last couple weeks because he's a huge Bernie fan. And I definitely don't want to call him a Bernie bro because I like him and I hate Bernie bros.
Yeah.
But he, every time I'll post, because the thing is, I've been getting really frustrated with the thing I likened it to yesterday is, I love Bernie Sanders, but much like Game of Thrones, his fans are ruining it for me because they're just, They're just too, like, in your face and too, like, because the thing is, they were showing up to, like, Pete Buttigieg rallies and then just, like, just, talking shit over all of him and, like,
who cares?
And protesting him and all this stuff. And it's like, okay, I get that you guys support Bernie. Go do that. Like, don't show up to other people's shit and, like, that you know, you're wasting your
time. Resources.
Exactly.
And then the Yang guy just, you know, bleeds out any of the Bernie followers. They segment there. And then Yang is the same. He's like Bernie part two.
Yeah, exactly. So I was talking to Ryan. Well, yesterday I was posting something about it. I occasionally enjoy it because right now the Bernie supporters are like internally combusting because I think he bought some ad space on Joe Rogan, and really far left people like hate Joe Rogan. And so like they're all just infighting now about like whether Bernie was right to buy this or whether like now they shouldn't trust him because he bought, you know, ad time on Joe Rogan.
I mean, that's assuming that like he's actually like made that decision himself and it wasn't just the people like
right.
Yeah, he, everyone is like, okay, how about we put an ad in this penny saver? What do you think?
Well, the fact that he allowed it to happen, I think, is what people are like mostly pissed about. And so I was like, you know, I love to see this, except you know that if Bernie isn't the candidate, they're all just going to vote for fucking Harambe or something. You know what I mean? Because that's what happened last time. And Ryan's like, but Bernie's going to be the candidate. He like writes back and like, but Bernie's going to be the candidate this time. And so I wrote back with a GIF that was just of Linus sitting in the Great Pumpkin Patch, like waiting for the Great Pumpkin to show up. And so this morning he was like posting that he was volunteering for the Bernie Sanders campaign. And I like I sent a clap emoji and he put a sad face. And I was like, no, I sincerely agree with you. Like, because the thing is, because I think he put crush capitalism or something like on the picture.
Nice.
And I was like, no, I sincerely agree with you because out here, and I know I'm the LA douchebag who always talks about LA, but like as far as like a culture shock, like there's you know wealth disparity everywhere, but it is so insanely obvious how bad the wealth gap is out here to the degree that I was just telling him, like people who own $3 million homes out here are like upper middle class. Like that's the wage disparity out here. Yeah. So
to own a home at all, you have to almost be like,
exactly. They said like 1 in 3 people in Los Angeles County own a home. Everybody else rents. So
nice.
Yeah. So to me, like I
agree. Which is probably more expensive than even owning.
It's probably because you're sinking about as much money a month into a mortgage as you are into rent, and at least then you get to keep the thing at the end. So it's just a matter of having the, you know, $500,000 up front to actually put a down payment on, which hardly anyone does. So, I totally agree with you in that regard. Like, if you can keep that stuff, the government does get increasingly more frustrating, I think, to deal with. I just find it impressive and almost to a... you seem very engaged to kind of stay out of, you know, for the things that you're passionate about. It seems like you work very hard toward.
Well, yeah, that's like, thank you. That's nice of you. But one of the things that people confuse about us is they think that we, with the comedically thing, we give a little bit of money and we don't really worry about money. Like a lot of times we'll do programs for 100% or something and people don't really get what the agenda is and they kind of get suspicious of that. And it's held us back in some ways. And I never explained it, but what people don't really realize is my life is basically like a nonprofit. Now, I'm separate from Megan, obviously. Like anything that, you know, Megan owns stuff, Megan has a normal life, and she's kind of, you know, more normal than me that way. But me personally, I run my life like a nonprofit. So I, in order for me not to have to pay or owe any taxes, I can't have any assets or any profits of any kind in my life ever.
Okay.
So what I do is what I get stuck with that goes over that limit, I just invest into comedy so that it can be written off. Because the one thing I want to make clear before Ted Nugent shoots an arrow all the way from into my skull is that I don't defraud or like I don't cost the system anything. I'm a positive to the system. Every year I'm owed tax refunds and I don't collect them. Like they called me one time, I didn't file for like 16 years, right? So they called me up and they're like, oh, you didn't file for 16 years, we want to know. And so I had, because I worked for a business or something, they had done my taxes and I just never mailed them in. So then I mailed them in like 3 years worth of the taxes and they got back to me and they're like, oh, you don't have to go to court.
Never mind. And
you don't have to mail in anything else. We're yeah. good.
Just kidding. We don't want to give you all the money we owe you.
What's so yeah. funny
well,
is...
Well, it wasn't a lot. What they said was that their excuse was that with all the penalties and fees I had accrued, it was basically going to be a washout, so don't worry about it.
That's what they want you.
That was about 10 years ago, and that's the last I've heard it. So.
That's so funny. I'm so, like, freaked out about law-abiding, like... I only ignored a jury summons once, and that was on accident, and...
Oh, that's, I forget.
I tried to pay a speeding ticket, like, 100 times last year, but they never put it in the court system, so, like, I eventually just gave up on it, and I'm sure that'll come back to bite me in the ass sometime.
It'll be somewhere when you're late. You're late, and you'll get pulled over, and then they'll be, like, trying to handcuff you for that.
Oh, yeah, for sure, for unpaid speeding tickets. And then I never actually knew that you could just not... file a tax, or like I just never actually knew that was an option, so that's
yeah you, well it's not unless they have you on file as them owing you money. I mean, it's really just a balance sheet is all taxes are.
I
mean, you have to be, first of all, you have to be what they call collectible in the world to be the target of anybody's bullshit, and I'm not collectible because I own what I'm wearing basically. and that's it. So I like it. A lot of people are terrified by it. And then this is where it gets kind of weird, and you stop me if things get too real. But along with being like having all the problems with seeing the things that you see at a young age and all the things that it does to you subconsciously, I've also for like probably 25 years had the philosophy like I don't have a retirement fund or health insurance. I don't go to the doctor or any of that shit. I just, you know, when it gets to be not fun, just, you know, bullets are very cheap. And that's really how I look at it. And people think that's a depressing outlook. And that, God bless you if that's a depressing outlook for you. But what's fucking depressing for me is just fucking limping into the Evermore or wherever you go after this. I just don't want to slither on out of here. You know what
so,
I mean?
Yeah.
I want to walk upright to wherever I'm going. And I don't care if that – it's part of it's a control freak thing. But people who think that
– I love it.
People who think that that's a weird or depressing outlook, I'm so, like, it makes me feel free every day.
The thing is, I will admit, like, the instinct when you first hear it, it's like, whoa. But then you really think about it, because that's the problem. Like, your instinct is always to say, like, whoa to that sort of stuff.
Say it the way, you know.
And, well, I mean, but the thing is, like, we were literally just talking about this the other day, how, like... We think euthanasia is an okay thing for our pets, but it's not okay for, like, humans, which is weird because, like, if the person is literally saying, like, no, this is shit. I don't want
to
do this.
It's inhumane to let, like, a
yes!
sick animal live. Why is it inhumane?
Yes!
I mean, it's not like I don't mean, when I say it, I don't mean it in some, like, oh, dude, I'm so psychotic. No, I mean, I'm not, if somebody honks their horn, I'd jump like anybody else. You know what I'm saying? I have all those instincts. I'm just saying that I've seen enough of both sides of that. Like, I've had the misfortune of having close friends, you know, die of gunshot, everything from gunshot wounds, cancer, blah, blah, blah. And family members now, I'm at that age where I have a lot of older family members. And, you know, watching people die of quote-unquote natural causes. Man, you only have to be brave for one second to pull the trigger, you know what I'm saying? Like,
well,
and that in no way is to encourage anyone to do anything terrible, you know what I mean?
No,
that's not about
no.
that. That's a thing where,
no,
like,
you're just talking about taking yourself out back when you're ready.
Yeah,
I'm talking about, like, instead of
die.
Instead of being like 100 years old and being like a drain on the system and just being miserable every day waiting for it, I'm really not that patient.
Something that haunts me, and I thought about a lot before even this happened, but, like, is the idea that, you know, you watch your grandparents and you watch your parents and you watch how, like, eventually it gets to a point, at least with all my grandparents, for most of my grandparents, it got to a point where it was like, are we just keeping them alive for our sake? You know what I mean? Like, are we just doing this because we don't want to lose them and we're going to miss them? And, like, do they really want to be alive? Like, is this really enjoyable for them? And then... My grandmother, my last surviving grandparent passed away in May, and what her thing was, like, she was literally, like, she lived alone, she did her own shit until, like, 6 weeks before she died. And
yeah, she's, like, how old was she? She was still, like, driving and everything?
No, so she, well, she actually, she much like Brent, related to the driving thing. And so she stopped driving when she was like 50. She was like, fuck it, I'm not doing this anymore.
That's how my grandma did, like, her early 80s. She's like, you know what? It's freaking me out. I'm done.
Yeah, when she was 50, like, she stopped driving. So, but, like, she lived alone and she was still killing it. And then 6 weeks before she died, she just got really sick and they put her into a nursing home. And she basically was just, like, in, like, bedridden for the last 6 weeks. And my dad, it was, like, so devastating. And again, not to be, like, a downer, but, like, this just gives you the whole perspective. My dad was texting me that, like I think, like, the last 2 weeks in, she knew, like, this is it. I'm on my way out. And then she was actually getting frustrated that, like, all right, I can die now. Like, she was literally just like, I can die now. Can someone please, like, put a pillow over my face? Because, like, I am ready to go.
Yeah.
And I'm not going. And what the hell? Like, she was just really frustrated that she wasn't going, even though she knew, like, she was on her way out. And thinking about that, it's like, oh, Jesus. Like, how like, maddening must that be that you just have to lay there and wait? You know what I mean? Like, that's
yeah, be
terrible.
Uncomfortable or
yes.
Impaired.
And you don't want to admit it. And this gets really, like, not that I'm trying to bite on John Armstrong's thing, but this, you know, you really see the pragmatic side in a negative way of people when they when someone's dying, because even the people who are passing away are like, oh, fuck, I'm fucking up everybody's schedule right now. You have to be at work, and you have to be at work, and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the people who have to be at work are like, oh, I really love you, but, you know, wah, come on. And it's like, holy crap, what has capitalism done to all of us, man? This is awful.
Yeah, no, that's such a great point. That's such a great point, because that's my grandmother, too. That's probably going to be me. It's like, no. Like, you go do your thing. Like, I'm just going to lay here. I might die. Like, and you know they're not. Like, you know they're not going to go anywhere. And, like, yeah, I mean, that's euthanasia, death with dignity. I'm all for it. If it ever comes up on the ballot here, I'm totally going to vote.
Well, and, I mean, I think just the one thing is nobody's allowed to choose what they want anymore. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, come on, if you're not hurting anybody else, let it go. But that's just, you know, that's just one part of it. And like I said, I think another way to do it would be, I've been, you know, I'm not the, when I was a kid, I was such a pussy, like I wouldn't get on roller coasters or anything. And so I'm thinking, if ever things get a little bit weird and I'm not loving this place too much, maybe I'll just start being like Travis Pastrana or something. You know,
just still reckless.
Throw a parachute out of a plane and see if I can go get it, like that movie. If you get it, you get it. If you don't, whatever. Free ride. Bill me later.
My biggest fear is I'll always get stuck halfway between, where I'll be like, just a vegetable. Like, I can't do anything.
That's the control freak in me. That's why I don't want to, you know, I don't want to teeter on the brink of anything.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would love to probably, that would be one of the first things I would do, because I know I'm too much of a pussy to go skydiving. I can tell myself I'm not, but the only way I would do it is if I didn't look out the door. And then I just kind of walked out real fast. And I know so many people who have gone skydiving, and I'm like, damn, they're braver than me. That sucks.
Or they're stupid for walking out of a perfectly good plane.
It's not that I'm afraid of it.
It's like, the plane is fine. It's not going down. This is unnecessary.
It's not, and that's the thing. It's my distrust of humans that really makes the fear. I'm not afraid of jumping out of a plane with a working parachute. I'm afraid of the fact that some asshole packed my parachute, like, and I'm going to definitely be the last parachute, like, right before lunch. And then, you know, like, they just haphazardly stuff it there, and it gets snarled on the way out, and I'm the statistic, because I'm lucky, and I was born on Friday the 13th.
There's so many, like, rules and regulations about that. Like, I was listening to one of my true crime podcasts, because I just listen to, like, murder all the time.
Me too, that's all I do.
It's like relaxing. Like when I get home, when I want to unwind, I'm just going to put on one of my murder podcasts and I'll play my little Tetris game. Like, it's just, that's how I relax.
That's how I am with the first 48. I watch it. And people are like, isn't that unsettling? I'm like, no, my life is awesome compared to everyone's life.
Like, look at all the ways I haven't
shit
died.
It's going
yet.
Great right now.
But then I kind of get the thing, like, I've never been, I don't know. Maybe I like to watch it because then, too, like, as a woman, it's, like, mostly women getting murdered, you know, and whatnot. And I'm just kind of like,
oh, wait, what one is?
Like, it's just, like, mostly, like, in all, like, the murder things, like, women just getting murdered all the time.
Yikes.
Or just, like, doing anything. Like, walking down the street, getting off a bus. And so it's, like, I listen to it sometimes. It's kind of like a things to avoid. Like, no. Don't do it over me. Feels like he could be more prepared, and yet then I just have like these reoccurring nightmares about like being grabbed or like bashed on the head or something. Wake up, freaking out. It's like it's never happened to me in real life.
Well, have you ever connected the fact that you watched people get bashed over the head and
That's
murdered all
saying.
Day long, and then you have recurring nightmares?
But you know what, actually,
experiencing the same thing.
I think it was actually before I got into that I was freaking out about it. So then maybe that's what led me into, like, watching it. I don't know.
No, I was going to say, my grandmother was actually a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, and so I have it in my genes to always be convinced that everyone's trying to murder me at all the time. So, like, I don't watch murder things because I already think people are always already trying to murder me. I don't need that inflamed any further.
Your whole life is, like, Final Destination.
Pretty much, yeah. I'm looking for ways that I'm about to die all the time.
I was on a guy one time, and I was like, I went to lock my car doors, and he's like, we're in Cleveland. I'm like, yeah.
Exactly.
We are.
If I could double lock them, I would.
Yeah, it's just like, I was like, how many dudes have, like, mocked me for being, like, paranoid? I'm like, that's because you don't have to be that paranoid, I guess, but, like, fuck you. Fuck you for saying, like, oh, what, are you going to hold your keys like that? Or what, do you have mace? Oh, okay.
He lived in a doorman building, probably.
Oh, my God.
He lived on the east side. I'm like, okay, so you know.
Like, I like watching stuff like The First 48. People think it's unnerving, but if you watch First 48's awesome, Naked and Afraid, Survivor, anything where their life is like total shit and you can have like a big sandwich or a pizza and a beer while you're watching, that's the best, man. I just love it. Basking in superiority over whoever's doing it.
It really does bridge that gap because, you know, when it happens to those people, it's usually like privileged individuals that are voluntarily putting themselves into a situation, and you're not just like, it's not enjoying the suffering and misery of people who don't deserve it.
Yeah, it's not like a homeless reality show.
Right, right.
No. Totally
up.
Voluntary.
They're choosing to go live this way.
Right.
You're just a mom who doesn't like her kids, wants to get on. You'd rather be on an island with 8,000 mosquitoes than your two kids.
I will say, speaking of kids, though, you talk about disengage. You're a good dad. You have kids.
I'm a dad.
You're a dad.
I came to learn early. There's two ways you can parent, right? You can parent by awesome example, like a LeBron James or some awesome person, which I could never do and be that good of an example. So I just parent by cautious, or what is it called?
Cautionary tales.
Yeah, cautionary tale. That would be my parenting style. Cautionary tale. Just, you can learn as much from not doing what I do, as long as you learn. That's all that matters.
I was thinking of, are you any part German by chance?
I'm almost all German.
I was going to say that's a very German thing. Like, they had the fairy tales in Germany where it was like, it was basically like some guy came around and like would get you in your sleep if you didn't like behave.
Oh,
and, like,
Everything's going to kill you if you don't follow the rules.
Yeah.
Nothing soothes like a German fairy tale.
That's the one where they cut off your thumbs or your hands or something, or like.
Oh, yeah, there's a couple. Like all those wonders that they cut off your thumbs, like if you suck your thumb.
I used to suck my thumb.
In the office.
Yeah, I used to suck my thumb all the time, and my grandpa would always. Oh, so my grandpa shot off his thumb when he was like 20 or something accidentally. And so he was missing one of his thumbs. And then all the time I would suck my thumb as a kid, and he'd always be like, do you know I sucked my thumb as a kid? And he would hold up his nub, and I'd always just be like, bah! But then I would just go right back to like sucking like nervously.
That didn't teach you. You didn't stop.
No, it made me more nervous. I was just like, bah! Then I like sucked on my thumb for comfort, and then my mom's like, okay, stop doing that. That's not helping anything. So,
that's hilarious.
Oh, uncle,
grandpa.
Oh, that was your grandpa?
Yeah, that's my grandpa. He was great.
That's awesome, man.
He's my favorite grandpa. He is my favorite grandpa. He's the one I credit with being like me, like being my ordinary self. Which is ironic, really, because by the end he was just super like grumpy and said like three words a day. And he was in the story I told a couple weeks ago. I had
were they? Where's my thumb?
where's my thumb?
Forgot again.
Well, I was telling a story to TM Francis a couple weeks ago, which we had like this ended up airing, but like. At his funeral, I told the story. I cleaned it up, but I told the story about how like he never said anything, and I was telling my grandmother that I was in my neighborhood of Ohio City one day, and this woman was wearing a shirt that said "I Heart Blowjobs," and it was really strange, just because this was before, like, you know, sex positive culture and all that, and like it was Ohio City was still kind of a bad neighborhood too, so like in the context, it just seemed real weird. And so I was like, "Oh, this woman was wearing an I Heart Blowjobs shirt," and she turns to my grandfather and she goes, "You know what a blowjob is?" And he doesn't say anything ever, and all of a sudden he's just like, "No, show me."
Show me.
Yeah. And so I cleaned it up for the funeral and said that she said French kiss, and he said, "No, show me." But
he's,
yeah,
self-censored?
Like, yeah, just because it was like the rest of my relatives are like real religious, and I was like, yeah, they don't want to hear the blowjob story. The blowjob story about my grandfather at his funeral, so.
You can parent, you know, I mean, because it was never, my son lives with us now, so it's a lot easier now that he's like 20 and successful and doing his own thing, because now he can parent me a little bit, you know?
Yeah, you're like, good, now you can finally take care of your father.
Do you have your son, or I felt like you had multiple kids, maybe I'm imagining.
I have two kids, but my daughter lives with her mom. My son has lived with us for like 7 years now. I think he came and lived with us when I was like 14, so.
That's cool.
He's fun. It reminds me that I used to be good looking.
Just walk around. This is my son. Legacy. Right? This is my legacy.
Every time I see him, I'm like, God damn, I miss young me.
You just tell Megan to like back off. I want you to appreciate this.
They're actually closer in age. She's closer to him in age than she is to me.
That's amazing.
Yeah, there's just something about knowing someone when they were a kid that just, you don't ever.
Yeah,
that'll
do it though. So. You're like, no, you're just like that stretch. You're like an 11-year-old, but just stretched out into something.
Exactly. Once you've seen someone go through pubescence, there's really no going back. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there'd have to be something weird if you knew somebody as a kid and then were sexually attracted to them later. It's like,
Woody Allen much?
Yeah.
Yeah, right? That would be a little weird.
It's even worse because that's supposed to be your kid.
Oh my God, speaking of Woody Allen and kids, I can't get over this and I want to talk about it all the time. So Mia Farrow and like all of Frank Sinatra's real kids always say that Ronan Farrow is not Frank Sinatra's kid. But come the fuck on. Have you ever looked at Ronan Farrow and Woody Allen?
I did see a picture, yeah.
Yeah, if you see Ronan Farrow and Woody Allen, and then you see Ronan Farrow and Frank Sinatra, there's no way it's not Frank Sinatra's kid. Like, there's just absolutely... Ronan Farrow is the most beautiful human being on the planet Earth, looks nothing like Woody Allen. Like, literally no part of
him. Well, yeah, you don't have to clarify after you said the first it's Woody Allen.
Yeah, the least attractive person.
Inside and out, not
inside
very
and out. Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Speaking
high
of
ones, put the high ones.
Speaking of Woody Allen, how did you transition from like the MMA stuff into like entertainment and comedy stuff?
Oh, I disengaged it, man. It got filthy when it caught on, and we got successful. Everybody wanted in, and everybody, mostly gambling, got into it. And I thought I was competing with the other leagues and shit like that, but they just were doing it to gamble. Like, they weren't trying to put on the most fair fights and the best fights. So I was promoting fights, and I was fighting myself. Well, I was a fighter, so the whole thing just lost its... It was supposed to be like, you know, kind of because I'm a anti-capitalist, socialist kind of person and disengager. That was one place that was cool because you knew exactly, you know, it's two guys who are willing to fight. You get in there. There's no bullshit. You don't have to sign any papers. You don't have to have any fucking paperwork. It's just beat the shit out of each other. It was real pure. But then when the Athletic Commission came in and gambling got involved, like everything, it got corrupted. So I don't even watch it anymore, really. And I work as a gambling consultant for people who place bets on MMA, and I get commissions for that. But we do have an algorithm. You just plug in the names, and it tells you if you should bet on them or not.
Oh, wow.
I watch an occasional fight, but it's just so bullshit now. Conor McGregor, no, he gets everything because he's some human cartoon character. And some guys, you know, it's probably the same as a lot of people in L.A. think about the acting, or as a lot of comedians I know. You know, you'll have somebody who will grind it out. like a Dave Attell for years and years, and then next thing you know, he's opening up for like Dane Cook. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. He's the feature before Dane Cook, and Dane Cook's the headliner, and it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, I mean, I think people ruin everything. I totally agree with that.
Definitely.
What was the transition when you finally got tired of all that bullshit to try and move into, like, what you guys do now?
That would be awful to go through. I'll give you the real, real short.
Yeah, whatever you want, yeah.
It took 8 years of my life, and it literally involved bribing judges, people doing articles about me from, like, there was an article from Canadians, Egyptians. It was one of the biggest stories in the whole history of MMA, but it really got hushed down because they bribed their way out of it. Got me pushed out of business, but on the hush-hush, I got, like, a little bit of a settlement that took care of my life for, like, the next 10 years. Good. If I wanted to live, like, really... really, you know, frugally, I wouldn't have to do anything. So I didn't do shit for 10 years, you know what I mean? I tried to hang out, and I had, you know, whatever, live my life, hung out with my kids and Megan. And then when we moved back to Cleveland, because we had to live in the Youngstown area for my kids, when I didn't have to do that anymore, I moved right back to Cleveland because I hated Youngstown. And once we moved back to Cleveland and started going to comedy shows, it seemed like a natural fit to try and work with comedy, since we had a lot of our, you know, I didn't have to work in the daytime or anything, and we could make some money and not need the money and give it all to the comedians and stuff. So it seemed like a natural fit, because I tried comedy that was another thing that I pissed away, you know. In 1994, I tried out at the Improv. They used to have Monday you could try out for the open mic night. They wouldn't just let you go up for open mic. You had to try out. Mm-hmm. And trials were noon on Mondays, and like 35 or 40 people would show up. And this guy named Lee, I think he would hold the tryouts. And after the first time I went up there, I did like shit. It was like 3 minutes. I was awful. I was stammering. I was so nervous. But he's like, oh, you're one of the only people who had any form to your jokes whatsoever. He's like, I'll work with you. And this is like 1994. So he said, you can be a touring opener. You can go from improv to improv around the country. And it's like $400 a week. I'll work with you here until you're ready. And then we're going to get a couple people, and we're grooming them to do that. And I was like, nah. I was like, fucking work and moving and traveling and stuff. So, and I just never went back. So I went to the Improv and tried out two times in 1994 and never did anything or even really went to any comedy shows until we went to one of Bill Squire's shows at Barrio. And we really liked it. And I was like, oh, this would be a cool thing. Because I noticed nobody made any money. And I'm like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
No, like, how are you guys not making money off this shit? It's hilarious. So that's really how we got into it.
That's so important. Because I think, and you guys have been a huge, I think, huge influence on the Cleveland comedy scene since you've come in.
That's nice of you to say.
Well, but it's so true. Because I think you guys, you organize a lot of events that no one else would do. And the thing is, because you specifically, you and Megan, devote, because that's your main focus, right? You're not trying to simultaneously run a show, but also boost your own sort of comedian career. That's really hard to do. You know, I mean, that's hard to do for anybody, but it's especially hard to do, like, if that's really, you know, if you've got like a side hustle that pays the bills, but then you're also trying to be a comedian, but then you're also trying to run shows, and you're also trying to promote the shows, and you're also trying to, like, that's too much, I think, for most people to do. And the fact that both of your main focus is to make the shows, promote the shows, give people a place to sort of
You're trying to elevate the community and not yourself.
Exactly.
You know, not necessarily yourselves.
Exactly.
Not that you're trying to keep yourself in the closet or anything, but
yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like overly pious or anything, but it really we treat it like a business, and we try and run it professionally like a business, but it's just for fun, you know what I mean? Like, we really do it because we want everyone to succeed. And you hit the nail on the head. The one fun thing is that Megan has her whole career with acting and modeling and stuff, but comedy helps her be more well-rounded. She's like, you know, not trying to, she's never professed to try and be a full-time comedian. Me, I want to be someone who is looked at as, I could do a solid 10, 30 minutes, whatever, but I have no aspirations of being famous. So if I have a spot where, like, sometimes at the Cleveland Comedy Open in the preliminary rounds, if a headliner has a conflict or if we don't have one scheduled, I'll do the 10-minute little filler thing. But I try not to take anything away from a spot that would be something for an up-and-coming comedian that would let them have some kind of spotlight, you know what I mean? Because that's not really what – that's not our function. That's not really why we got into it. I'm just happy to be a Klingon and, you know, be able to – I mean, getting to get into hilarities for free for shows and shit.
Yeah.
It's fun, man. Just walk in there and see shows. And it's fun to just – you know what it is. You guys are the same way. You to hang out with comedians, you know, we make fun of it and stuff. But it's pretty fun. Comedians are a fun group to hang out with. And it's pretty tight-knit little community. So it's we're lucky to be a part of it. It's a blast.
Yeah. Regarding the Cleveland comedy community, something I was just talking about one of our previous episodes is, like, it's hard to make friends out here, so I'm so glad that I made friends with everybody back home because I stay really tight with everybody back home. We stay in close touch, we stay in communication, and then when I come home, it's great. I feel like Norm walking into Cheers. Everyone's just like, Jess!
So why are you suntan, bitch?
I know. That's it. When I came home, like, six people told me I looked tan, and I'm like, I think you're delusional because I don't go outside. Like, I don't know how I look tan because I don't go outside.
In their heads, they're being jealous.
Everyone thought I looked tan. But what I was gonna say is, like, what you were talking about with you and Megan is that you do this for fun. Those are the things that ultimately end up being the most successful because they don't reek of effort. You know what I mean? They don't reek of like trying too hard because you're really just doing it for something to enjoy. And, like, I mean, that's why I do this podcast. Like, obviously this is a very hackneyed thing that, like, you know, half the time the audio sucks and, like, I delete the episode and, like, I fuck it all up, but I do it because it's fun and it helps me stay in touch with my friends back home and helps me learn, like, interesting things about them. And I think that's the thing. When you're just ultimately having fun with it, those are the things that really tend to take off.
Yeah. I mean, if it's so basic sometimes. Life is like no in between. It's either overly complicated or overly basic. So I try and stay super basic. But if it's, you know, if you feel positive about how you're using your time and anything you do, that's probably a good thing to be doing.
Yeah. And I know you and I and me and Megan have talked about this too. Like, I totally agree with the idea that it's important to have other things. Like, hustle culture is fine. You know, hustle culture when you're, you know, just constantly, you know, doing the thing all the time, you know, it's important. But I think that's how people get burnt out too. It's how people, when they only focus on one thing all the time, just stand up.
One thing isn't going well, then it's like your everything's fucked.
Yes. And so, like, to have a well-rounded sort of philosophy of, you know, I'm going to do comedy, but I'm also going to act, but I'm also going to model, but I'm also going to write, but I'm also going to produce, but I'm also going to, when you have all those things, you tend to get less burnout. You tend to get a more well-rounded idea of, like, what people are expecting from all perspective. You know what I mean?
I mean, you can also find more stuff that you like to do. Maybe you're liking something more than something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you get more job opportunities that way too. Yeah.
Exactly. You have, like,
a multifaceted, multi-talented.
Yeah, she's more driven than I am for that. Like, she wants jobs and she wants to do stuff and she would like to be probably some level of fame and success in her career, and good luck. I mean, that's awful. I mean, you know, everybody, I respect her and she's doing a great job. She does such a good job in everything. She's the professional side of everything we do. I shit out some idea and then she makes it real. You know what I mean? So there's really, she does all the heavy lifting. So she applies that same work ethic to all the other things she does. So
yeah, Megan,
we're very different in that way.
Megan's amazing. You guys should check her out. She was on a episode of Mindhunter this last year. So you definitely can see her there. And she's in a lot of the Northeast Ohio, like, commercials. You'll see her in, like, Honda ads.
Canton Airport.
Yeah.
I remember because I was talking to her. I ran into her.
Somebody got to pay these bills, man.
Or she was, like, out with her mom or something, and then I saw her, and she's just like, oh, I haven't seen it yet. I'm like, I'll tell you when I see it. Because she said, let me know if you see it, because sometimes I watch the news in the morning, and I'll come on, I'll be like, Megan, I saw it! You're on!
So normally I'd let this ride for another, like, a couple more minutes, but I know you guys have a ton of really cool stuff that you do, and if you want to talk about some of it or promote some of it, I would love to kind of put some of that out there.
Oh, all we really care about is the Cleveland Comedy Awards on March 30th at Hilarities.
Be fun. So with that, anybody who's listening who's a comic, which is pretty much all 20 of the people who listen to this show, right now they can go to comedically.com.
Yeah, comedically.com, and then we're comedically on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook as well.
Okay, and for Cleveland-based comedians, if you go to Cleveland or comedically.com, you can register to nominate individuals for the Cleveland Comedy Awards, correct?
Yeah, Megan runs all the registration. You have to be a comedian with, you know, there's a basic minimal amount of activity that you have to have doing comedy. But yeah, once you register, you can not only make nominations, but then once the nominations are made, you can vote on things. And that way, you know, people have asked us to open it up to the public, but we're not really interested in doing that. The Scene Magazine already does something like that, so it would just be repetitive. And we like it to be kind of like, you know, a peer voting type thing.
I agree, because, and the thing I love about you doing it that way is it then does not become every bringer show where you just tell your friends and family to vote for you and then they do. It's not a popularity contest. It is literally like, oh, people who legitimately know you and know who you are and have seen what you do are saying that you deserve this.
And begrudgingly vote for you instead of themselves.
It's true. That's what I usually end up doing because I think that there are so many people who deserve to be acknowledged for all the hard work they do, because it can be a thankless thing, even in the you know, especially in the Cleveland comedy scene. You know, you don't always, and it can be discouraging for people when they don't, you know, they work at it a couple of years and people still don't really know who they are. And so to have that sort of like rookie of the year status, or to have best joke, or to have those kinds of things, I think really is encouraging for them to keep doing it.
Our best podcast.
You get the awards thing. That's the whole reason we did it. Like, it's all, there was so much going on when we would go to like Barrio when we first got back in town and stuff. And we were like, holy shit, man, there's a lot of really good like underground comedians here, like the Jimmy Grahams and everything from Mike Pogue, all those people, man. All the way down to, you know, when John Armstrong and Brian Stoenig, all the people starting out, you guys, everything. Spider Jones. So it was like, man, what could we do to make Cleveland seem, you know, how there's like Chicago has Second City and all that stuff. So really the award show was just a shine job for us, you know, like, hey, let's make, we have an awards show and you don't, you know, our city has comedy awards. So if someone from Cleveland was going up for a job against someone from Boise, Idaho, you could say, hey, I was nominated for a Cleveland Comedy Award, and maybe it'll get you a job or something, even if they don't know that it's not really a huge award show or something.
I feel like it's cool. It's like our prom night or something.
It's true.
It does have a certain prom kind of vibe.
I love that, because I never had, like, I was such an awkward kid and everything. Like, I never went to dances with boys or anything, and I'm like, ooh, now I can go and get dressed up.
Yeah, and this one's actually fun, and you can drink without getting thrown out.
Yeah, right. I'm like, please spike the punch.
Right. No, it's fun. I like to make the one thing that we always try every year, and I hope this year I think we're going to succeed, because big shout out also to Logan Rashaw, who wrote a lot of last year's show and the intro video and all that stuff. And he's a super professional guy and awesome to work with. And we have some people working with us this year, but it's a surprise, so I'm not going to shout out to them until next year. But making it a spectacle is like the number one priority. So hopefully this year it'll be beyond the last 2 years. And it's always fun just to see the different outfits. I never stop getting a kick out of that, man. It's hilarious to me.
Do you guys do that?
We wore a purple tux last year.
I know Larry did purple tux, and he looked amazing.
Larry's awesome.
Oh my God, I love Larry. They want the best podcast so bad. And it almost feels, I always kind of almost sort of feel, not guilty, but like a version of guilty, because it's just like, they want it so bad. And like, it's been 2 years, and so they're already campaigning this year
That's so coincidental, because we're going out to a Larry show tonight.
So great. Yes. Yeah, I would promote it, but this won't air until like the end of February. But do you guys do game show live too?
We do. We do it at the 9 on usually either the first or second Thursday of every month. The schedule's on that Eventbrite, and it's on the 9's website. But yeah, it's just a little game show that we run in the Alex Theater inside the 9. It's a fun little time.
That always looks fun. You guys are on at ComedicallyCLE on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook?
Yeah, everything we're on is on under that little moniker.
All right, Comedically. Is there anything else you guys coming up that you want to promote?
Nope, I'm avoiding stuff, man. I want to go to other people's stuff.
All right.
we could promote other people's stuff, but I don't know what's coming up. The Rubber City, the Cleveland Comedy Festival is expanding to Akron, man.
That looks fun. Yeah, I saw that.
A lot of cool stuff going on in Cleveland.
Their logo was so cute. It's the fucking Goodyear blimp with a little smiley face on it. I love it. It was brilliant.
I love it. Polk's on the news now.
Yes, Polk's on the news.
I was laughing. I was watching the news one morning, and it came up like one of his little clips, like Polk was on, you know, these days of the week at this time. And it's just like a bunch of clips of it. I'm like,
Polk's on the news. So yeah, no, I love it. It's almost kind of like after Animal House, where you get to see where everybody ended up, and everybody's doing great, and it makes me happy. Liz,
it is fun.
Speaking of promotion, do you have anything you want to promote? Shows, Carrot Pants, anything like that?
Nope. Go see comedy, Cleveland Comedy Open, Cleveland Comedy Awards, Cleveland Comedians. Go see stuff if you're in LA. Buy a ticket to Cleveland. It's sunny, we promise.
Yeah. No,
it's been warmer here than there several times this year.
It's true.
It's 90 right now. Come on down.
Yes, anybody who's in Cleveland, go do comedy Cleveland stuff. Anybody who's in LA and you're in Cleveland, holy shit, there's lots of stuff to do comedy-wise. In Cleveland.
And a lot of it's free, too.
Most of it
is free. Super Bowl champs.
Yeah. you can find me at Epic Fall on Instagram and Twitter, and you can find us at The Default Setting Pod on Facebook. And I want to thank OK Pants and at Above Below Entertainment. And I especially want to thank Brett Gambrill for being our guest today.
Thanks, Brett.
Thank you for having me. It's awesome.
We miss you. You're so much fun. You're such a good time.
I miss you guys too. Tell Adam I say hi.
I will. Kay, love you. Bye.
Bye.